Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. Israel's parliament, the Knesset, has passed a bill to effectively ban UNRWA, the UN's agency responsible for providing healthcare, education and humanitarian aid to Palestinians. Israel has accused the organisation, which employs a large number of Palestinians in Gaza, of allowing Hamas militants to infiltrate its staff, an allegation UNRWA strongly denies. After more than a year of war, almost 2 million Gazans have been displaced, and there are widespread warnings from humanitarian organisations that Gaza is facing a critical shortage of food, medicine and fuel, making aid more vital than ever. Well, Israel has faced a slew of opposition from its international allies over this is ahead of the bill passing this evening. The US has said the legislation is deeply concerning, and earlier today, speaking in the UK Parliament, the British Foreign Minister David Lammy had this to say.
In every war zone, every refugee camp, the United Nations is a beacon of hope. And so it's a matter of profound regret that the Israeli Parliament is considering shutting down UNRWA's operations. The allegations against UNRWA's staff earlier this week were fully investigated and offer no jurisdiction for cutting off ties with UNRWA. This weekend, we therefore joined partners in expressing concerns at the Knesset's legislation and urged Israel to ensure UNRWA's life-saving work continues.
The British Foreign Minister David Lammy there. Well, let's hear more now from our Middle East regional editor who's in Jerusalem, Sebastian Usher.
The debate lasted a couple of hours. A number of people spoke. I don't think there was much speech in favour of UNRWA. The sense in the Israeli parliament, in the Israeli government, which has been there for a long time against the UN, against UNRWA, essentially feeling that they are biased institutions against Israel, has really hardened since October the 7th, the Hamas-led attacks. And we had allegations several months ago that 12 members of UNRWA were directly involved. Now, that was investigated, and it was found that there were some issues about neutrality, and 9 of those staff who were investigated, it was found that there was some evidence they may have been involved. But for the main kind of allegations, that's not the case. So I think this was expected that it would go through.
OK, and just briefly, Sebastian, I mentioned that there's been international criticism of this. Can you fill us in a little bit more on that and how strong that international condemnation has been?
Well, yes. I mean, there's a statement by the US State Department. I mean, just as the vote was going ahead, saying that the US had contacted the Israeli government to express its deep concern about this. And we had many countries, including the UK, Germany, Australia and Canada, who issued a warning earlier in the day, essentially saying that the already desperate conditions in Gaza could be made much worse by this. I mean, UNRWA is the lifeline. I think it's indisputable for people there, also in refugee camps across the region. But obviously Gaza is where it's been most important. It provides the healthcare, provides the distribution of such aid as comes in very difficult circumstances. And there's nothing to replace it as things stand. I mean, Israel, the Israeli government, has talked about providing a new way of getting that aid to the Palestinians without UNRWA, saying essentially UNRWA has perpetuated this sense of Palestinians being refugees for the past 70 years, and that's one of the reasons why it must come to an end. But in the desperate situation in Gaza at the moment, I think the general feeling, as expressed by those countries, by the US, is that it has to be there. It can't be removed. Now, this won't do that immediately, but it will make UNRWA, it will make its operations that much harder. It will be a blow to its operations in Gaza and the occupied West Bank at a really, really desperate moment.
Our Middle East regional editor, Sebastian Usher, in Jerusalem. Well, Sharon Haskell is a member of the Israeli Knesset for the National Right Party. She was the MK that brought one of the two bills forward this evening. I spoke to her about an hour ago on the line from Tel Aviv, and I asked her, why has Israel made this decision, given the desperate need for aid in Gaza?
The fact is that there are mountains of evidence that a vast majority of UNRWA workers in Gaza are in fact Hamas terrorists, Hamas activists.
Sorry, what evidence do you have for that? You're saying the vast majority of UNRWA workers. I mean, let's just recap what our correspondent said. He said there had been investigations. If you just let me finish a moment, they did find that a very small number may have some links to Hamas.
No, no, no.
But the government hasn't provided evidence of any other.
That's a lie. That's a misleading. That's misleading your audience. We have sent mountains of evidence, including workers. Actually, last week, a report by the United Nations confirmed that UNRWA workers had participated in the 7th of October massacre. We have sent those evidence also to foreign ministers, to, if you ask the UK intelligence community, they will be able to provide you with a lot of this information. The fact is that the former UK government didn't continue to fund UNRWA because they knew that when sending that money,
that decision
it will
was
end up
reversed,
in the hands of
wasn't
terrorists.
It? That decision
well,
was reversed.
It was,
but look,
it was reversed by a lot of electoral pressure.
We've got 2 million people in Gaza displaced multiple times. We've got 42,000 people dead, killed over the past year in Gaza. A very large number of those are children. We've got very many children who are now orphaned. They don't have any parents to look after them or to try and help them navigate through this terrible humanitarian situation. We've got the winter coming. We've got hospitals that don't have enough supplies. We know that there are places where people are starving. Are you confident and comfortable with that being on your doorstep? And how do you propose to get aid in if it's not through UNRWA?
So there's two things. The first thing, obviously, that's a huge tragedy. And that tragedy lies on the hands of Hamas. I mean, if Hamas on the 8th of October would have surrendered and handed out 250 hostages, that wouldn't have never happened. Okay? Now, the second thing is, after we understand that this is at the hands of Hamas, you need to understand that UNRWA is not an organization that's capable of supplying such a humanitarian aid in the capability of what had happened in this region. The World Food Organization, UNICEF, the World Health Organization, they have the facility, the logistic, and the experience to actually work through an operation like that. UNRWA doesn't have this capability. And the fact is that because Hamas had taken over this organization, they are stealing the humanitarian aid and they're selling it in the market.
Briefly,
the solution is that the United Nations will take responsibility. And as it gives an answer in many other war zones and disastrous area, it needs to send the proper agency that are capable of supplying the humanitarian aid.
Sharon Haskell there, member of the Israeli Knesset for the National Right Party, who put forward one of the bills passed earlier today. Well, we've asked UNRWA for an interview this evening in response to what's happened. Juliet Toomer is the communications director at UNRWA, and she sent us this voice note with her reaction.
The vote by the Israeli parliament or Knesset against UNRWA this evening is unprecedented. It sets a dangerous precedent, and it opposes the UN Charter and violates the State of Israel's obligation under international law. It's beyond a concern to all of us. It's a threat to our common humanity. The time to act is now, is really now. There's no more time to waste. Enough is enough. It's time for a ceasefire in Gaza. It's time to release the hostages. It's time to allow humanitarian agencies, especially UNRWA, the largest humanitarian organization, the backbone of the humanitarian operation for the past 1 year. It's time to allow us to do our work. Just allow us to do our work. Enough. Enough.
Juliette Toomer, their communications director at UNRWA, sending us that voice note. And thank you to her for that. Well, let's cross live now to New York because we can speak to Ricardo Perez. He's spokesperson for UNICEF. That's the UN Agency for Children. Ricardo, welcome to the programme. First, briefly, your response to what's happened in the Knesset tonight.
Thanks for having me. You know, we've been saying over and over for many months, and this has been also said by our UN Secretary General, highlighting the importance of UNRWA's role in the state of Palestine and in Gaza indeed. And we've been urging UN member states to continue funding UNRWA, as we need it, as Juliette was saying, as the backbone of our humanitarian operation. So this hasn't changed. And now with what has happened today with the bill passed by the Knesset, okay, we're indeed very concerned with what the impact that it will have on children.
All right. Well, we heard from Sharon Haskell there saying that other agencies, possibly such as UNICEF, could pick up the slack, could go in and deliver the aid. What's your response to that?
Absolutely not. We cannot replace UNRWA. And that's a very important point that needs to be made and reinforced. UNICEF and the Palestinian people in Gaza, I would say, especially children, need UNRWA to remain the indispensable and irreplaceable arm of the humanitarian response it has proven to be over the last 13 months and since the onset of the conflict in the Gaza Strip since October 7th. They've been crucial in delivering life-saving aid to the Palestinian population, who are heavily dependent on its services. And so is UNICEF. We cannot operate fully and successfully across the Gaza Strip without UNRWA support.
Okay, I mean, but those such as Sharon Haskell do have a point that some UN aid generally has got into the hands of Hamas one way or another over the years that it's been being sent there. And, you know, there is that accusation that the aid agencies haven't done enough to make sure that doesn't happen.
Indeed. Look, the situation in Gaza over the last 13 months has become chaotic, apocalyptic for people living there. So it's expected, and indeed it has happened before, that humanitarian supplies due to civil unrest and the despair of people end up being looted. That does not mean UNRWA doesn't have a place in this humanitarian response and operation. Okay. And we do have robust systemic measures to safeguard aid and make sure that the distribution of supplies is done according to the needs of people.
Okay, briefly, is there anything that the UN could do in response to this to get Israel to change its mind or to punish it even?
Well, I would say, at least speaking for UNICEF, we need to continue to put pressure on member states to understand that UNRWA is indeed indispensable and irreplaceable. It's a backbone of the humanitarian response in Gaza right now, and UNICEF and other UN agencies needed to be there.
All right. Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us live on the line there from New York. That's Ricardo Perez, spokesperson for UNICEF. That's the UN Agency for Children. Coming up later, the confessions of a Vietnamese people smuggler.
It's a very lucrative business. If you have a good reputation, the clients come to you. No force, no violence.
You told the British authorities you've been trafficked here, but that's not true, is it?
No, I was not trafficked here. I said I was, because that's just the way it's done. It's what you say in order to get asylum.
More on that story to come, and a reminder of our top headlines this hour. The Israeli parliament has voted to ban the UN agency working with Palestinian refugees. And US prosecutors have filed a suit to try to stop Elon Musk from giving million-dollar payouts to voters in election battleground states. And we'll be looking at the US election a little bit later in the programme. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Thousands of people have been outside Georgia's parliament in Tbilisi tonight to protest against the ruling Georgian Dream Party winning the election. The protesters say they stole it. The US State Department has joined European countries calling for a swift investigation of reports of election-related violations. Among those addressing the protesters tonight was the opposition president, Salome Zurabishvili, I do apologise, and she spoke earlier to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, who's also in Tbilisi.
Madam President, you called the election a Russian special operation, a Russian election. You spoke of Russia's infiltration in Georgia. Are you suggesting that Moscow directly interfered in what you're calling a fraudulent election?
I don't know. It will be very difficult to say whether they directly intervened, but propaganda before the elections was a propaganda that was directly inspired from the Russian propaganda that we have seen during Putin elections. What I was mentioning when I say that this was a Russian operation, that it was a very sophisticated type of frauds that was not the regular, what we have seen in Georgia as in any of the countries of this ex-Soviet space. I don't like post-Soviet space.
By calling people onto the streets, what do you hope to achieve? The election's over. Georgian Dream isn't going to turn around and say the election was unfair.
Well, first of all, I think that it's a call to our partners to see and understand what is happening here. The will of the Georgian people, which was to be reflected in these elections, is to keep its European future. My call was to have a demonstration of where does the Georgian population stand, and I think we're going to see it tonight.
How concerned are you that this confrontation could end in violence?
It's not designed as a confrontation. It's going to be very peaceful. If you have seen the way the Georgian population demonstrates, it's always very peaceful. And I don't think that the authorities will want to turn that into a confrontation.
President Salome Zurabishvili there speaking to the BBC's Steve Rosenberg. Well, earlier we caught up with the BBC's Rehan Dimitri, who gave us a sense of the mood in Tbilisi.
Earlier this evening, there was a large demonstration. Thousands of people came. It was the first big kind of protest following the Saturday's parliamentary elections. And people came draped in the EU flags, in Georgian flags. And they came to listen to the opposition leaders. The first person who addressed the protesters was President Salome Zurabishvili. And she told them that they didn't lose the election, but that their votes were stolen. And the overall mood, I would say, was yes, it was a peaceful rally, but people are somehow, it feels like they are ready to fight for their country's European future, but it doesn't feel like there's a clear plan. So the main demand from the opposition leaders at this protest was new elections. And they said that they're not willing to negotiate with the Georgian Dream Party, and they're just demanding new elections.
And briefly, any indication that there will be an investigation into those reports of election-related violations?
Well, that's what a number of European leaders and politicians and members of European Parliament have called. They've urged the Georgian Dream government to swiftly investigate those reports of violations in order to also give some kind of assessment. And I guess what people are expecting here is whether or not the Western leaders will recognize these parliamentary elections as being legitimate or not. And I think that will only come after those violations are investigated.
The BBC's Rehan Dimitri in Tbilisi there.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Trees play an essential role on our planet, and not just in producing clean air, but in providing habitats for animals, fungi, insects, everything really. They perform many other functions as well. They're quite literally fundamental to our Earth's ecosystem. But now scientists warn that more than a third of all tree species in the world are facing extinction. The International Union for Conservation of Nature has published its first global tree assessment, and they've highlighted around 16,000 types of tree that they're worried about. Experts have been gathering in Colombia for a UN biodiversity summit, and they're calling for governments to step up efforts to restore nature and protect wild spaces. Well, earlier today I spoke to the appropriately named Emily Beach. She's the coordinator of the Global Tree Assessment Project that led the research, and she told us why trees are so important.
They're quite key in the oxygen production, but also trees are something we rely on for so many different things. So there are over 2,000 species that are used for medicines, for example. Over 2,000 different types are used for food, and then also fuels, as well as timber for construction. So there is a huge list of things that trees do for us.
And they also have an impact on the soil and keeping soil together and so on, don't they? Is this depletion of the tree species, is that equally across the globe, or are some places more affected than others?
So I think the best thing about this project is we looked at each individual tree species separately and assess the conservation risk to each species separately. So there's 57,000 different types of tree species. And now we can say the global numbers, like 38% of trees are threatened with extinction. But we can also say where the threats are and what threats are affecting which species where. So now we can see some patterns. So agriculture and logging are the most important threat all over the world for tree species.
Sorry to interrupt, but I suppose we're short of time, but I suppose because you've isolated those facts, it means there maybe something can be done about it.
Yes. So the whole point of this project is to create the data that we can then use to make sure that we prioritise conservation actions in the right place for the right species.
Mm-hmm. And which part of the world is most affected, briefly, if you could tell us?
So I would say all parts of the world have a threatened tree species. So there's 192 countries that have a threatened tree species. So there's work to do everywhere. Some places have more tree species than others. So Madagascar has 1,800 species of threatened tree, and the UK only 35. Okay. But there's still things to be done everywhere.
And that was Emily Beach there, who coordinated the Global Tree Assessment Project for the International Union for Conservation of Nature. And if you go to their website, IUCNRedList.org, you can see more details about those endangered trees and what sort of wildlife lives in them. Lots of details there about what could be at risk if we lose those tree species. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. To the United States now, and if the results in next week's US elections are as tight as the polls suggest that they will be, could the outcome actually be decided by the courts? And even if a winner is announced on the 5th or the 6th next week, could the losing side contest the result, potentially plunging the country into protracted political chaos with unknown consequences? Over the past few months, dozens of lawsuits have been filed by both the Republican and Democratic parties, chiefly in the seven battleground states that all the experts say will make the difference in this election. But with what purpose in mind? You may remember that after the 2020 election won by Joe Biden, Donald Trump's team tried to challenge the results in court. Most cases were dismissed for being filed too late. So are both sides preparing now to fight it out in court? Our correspondent Mike Wendling has been looking at the details and told us more.
Both parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, they're putting together huge teams of lawyers in advance of the election. In one sense, this is nothing new. It happens all the time in U.S. elections. But we do have evidence that the flurry this year of lawsuits is much larger than ever before. Our colleagues at BBC Verify ran the numbers, and they found in the last 4 months or so, there's been more than 100 of these lawsuits filed, mostly by Republicans, Republican-leaning groups and their allies, although there are lawsuits being filed by a Democratic Party and its allies.
So what kind of things are they complaining about? What are the actual lawsuits in substance?
There is a huge range of things that are mentioned in these lawsuits, right? So I'll just give you a few examples: that states are not adequately maintaining their voter registration rolls, that they are not trying to prevent non-citizens from voting. We have seen lawsuits about the time and place and manner of voting. In other words, how late polls are going to be open and how voters can cast their vote by mail-in ballot or by absentee ballot. There's a huge range. Generally speaking, Republicans look to restrict voting from ineligible voters, right? Because they say that dilutes the power of eligible voters. Democrats more often want to expand voting or stop voter rolls from being, quote, cleaned up, because they argue that discourages people from exercising their right to vote and that people who might be eligible to vote might be kicked off by mistake.
Mike, on that point of possible ineligible voters or voter fraud, do we have independent evidence that that has been an issue in elections? I mean, like, are local authorities worried about that, the kind of electoral authorities in any given state, which are normally supposed to be independent, aren't they?
Election officials are generally not concerned about large numbers of, for instance, non-citizen voters. I mean, it has been a constant theme of the Donald Trump campaign, dating back into previous campaigns. For many years, he's alleged that immigrants vote against the law. What people have found on the ground, and this includes conservative think tanks, liberal think tanks, and election officials, some of whom are allied with Donald Trump and members of the Republican Party, they have found cases where this has happened, but in very small amounts. So I'll give you one example. A recent examination of voter rolls in Ohio by a Republican official, 8 million voter registrations, found about 600 people on that list were ineligible to vote. Of those, it's unclear actually if or how many actually cast a vote in the past. So it's a very, very small number in the larger scheme of things.
Right. But I mean, one of the concerns many Republicans have had is that they have claimed that there's a politicization of the legal system in the US. Is the US system particularly vulnerable to allegations of politicization, and why?
Judges here tend to be appointed, and federal judges at the federal level will be appointed by the president. You know, you really have to kind of break it down by state, by district, to see who appointed that particular judge. When I was talking about the lawsuits in 2020, many were fielded by judges that Donald Trump himself had appointed, and none of those lawsuits went anywhere. So there is a core sort of independence of the judiciary here that has not been completely politicized in a way that you might expect.
So, Mike, it seems as if lawyers on both sides of the political divide are squaring up, ready for next week. How do we think that may play out? What kind of impact might it have on the election, particularly if the results are very marginal or not clear?
So we are going to have lawsuits that are filed up until Election Day, during Election Day itself. Parties have assembled these teams of lawyers. They are not going to they're not going to close up shop overnight. If it's as close as everybody thinks, they'll be fighting for every last vote in every last state. And part of that will come through the legal system.
And could that lead to quite a lot of political destabilization, potentially?
The experts that I've talked to are worried about that prospect. They are gearing for it. They are trying to do things at a number of different levels inside government and outside government to prepare for some of this, whether it be misinformation floating around online or lone wolf actors perhaps targeting the political process. Everybody here is on edge.
The BBC's Mike Wendling in Chicago. Well, earlier I spoke to one of Donald Trump's closest legal advisers. In fact, he's being touted by some as a possible attorney general in a future Trump administration. Mike Davis is a lawyer and founder of the Article 3 Project, which is an advocacy group that wants to make the US judiciary more conservative, they say, or in his own words, a hell of a lot more conservative. I asked him why the Republican Party and affiliated groups were filing so many lawsuits before the vote. But first, he told me why he thought they wouldn't be necessary.
I actually think President Trump is going to win in a landslide. I think he's going to win the national popular vote. I think he's going to win it comfortably. I think he would have beat President Biden by 1 or 2 points, but I think he's going to beat Vice President Kamala Harris by 3 or 4 points. I think President Trump is going to win all 7 swing states, and I think that he could surprise people on election night by winning places like Virginia, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Maine, places like that, so long as Trump supporters show up and vote as early as possible. Now, you're seeing lawsuits by both sides ahead of the election because where I think that there are issues is with signature verification and election observers and non-citizens voting. These are preventative measures to make sure that there's not widespread voter fraud. In Virginia and Texas, the Virginia governor found 6,000 non-citizens who were illegally registered to vote.
We've heard from the Virginia governor, Glenn Youngkin, saying there's no evidence that any non-citizens have tried to vote during his term in Virginia.
Well, in Texas, Texas governor Greg Abbott found 2,000 non-citizens who have voted in prior elections. And so, remember, it is illegal to be registered to vote as a non-citizen separate from voting.
Looking back to the 2020 election, 62 lawsuits were filed after that. These are challenges from the Trump administration at the time. 61 of them failed. So doesn't that suggest that the same thing could happen again?
This is routine for both sides to seek injunctions ahead of elections. And I think where President Trump's legal team failed in 2020 is they did not get injunctions before the election. And so if you wait to file lawsuits after the election, it is very difficult to get a judge to throw out an entire state's election because that really becomes the only remedy.
Doesn't it call into question, though, the entire system? And, you know, Americans are going to the polls to make this important choice in their lives, to cast their ballots. And it sounds from what you're saying that they shouldn't have confidence in the system. Are you saying that the system doesn't work?
Not at all. I think that our system works very well. And when these lawsuits are filed ahead of the election, you have judges make a determination before the election if the states or the local officials are actually following the law. And if they're following the law, great, you move forward. If they're not following the law, you correct it before the election so you don't have a problem after the election where it is a nightmare to file lawsuits after the election.
I just want to ask you about a couple of comments you've made yourself. You are quoted as having said that you plan to rain hell on Washington. You would want to send journalists and former GOP personalities, including George Conway and Tim Miller, to a gulag. You want to put migrant children in cages. I mean, that doesn't sound legally fair.
I make these outrageous statements to prove my point that a politicized and weaponized justice system against your political enemies is very bad for a republic. It's how the Roman Republic fell. And as I've said consistently with my trolling is that President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris have politicized and weaponized.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.